Hi, all. Welcome to another episode of Nutrition Pearls, the podcast from NASPGHAN's Council for Pediatric Nutrition Professionals, or CPNP. I am your host, Melissa Talley, pediatric GI dietitian at Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago. Joining me today is my co-host, Megan Murphy, pediatric GI dietitian at UCSF Benioff Children's Hospital in Oakland. Hi, Megan. How are you doing today?
Hey, Melissa. I'm doing really well. I cannot believe this is our last episode of 2023. Isn't that wild?
It's crazy to believe that we just started prepping for everything this past year, and just to see how far it's come in just a year is amazing.
It is. What's your favorite moment of the podcast this past year?
Ooh, that's a tough one, because I feel like even with, you know, the learning curves we had in the beginning, everything has just been so rewarding and awesome to see. But I guess my favorite moment would be in San Diego at the NASPGHAN conference, where we had our table set up and got to network with all of our listeners and really got to get some really great feedback from everyone. And of course, got to meet all you guys in person, you know, Megan, Bailey, Jen. We all finally got to see each other in the real world, not just over screen.
Yeah. No, that's so funny. I was just reflecting on that too. And I was thinking the same exact thing. Like, it was so nice. We worked so hard just getting episodes up and learning everything and doing it all this year. And then meeting each other in person was so nice. And meeting everyone, like some of our guests in person, was really cool to chat with them and our listeners, which made it really feel real that we were like really a podcast. We did it. So yes. It was a great first year. I'm really excited about 2024.
Me too. A lot more good things to come from Nutrition Pearls.
I think so.
All right. So shifting to our nutrition topic today, would you like to introduce our guest?
Yes, absolutely. So our guest today is Vanoush Kalami, and she's going to discuss cultural humility and diversity in pediatric nutrition. And we're going to get specifically into some infant feeding diversity topics. Vanoush is a board-certified pediatric dietitian nutritionist. She's also the founder of Niche Noosh, a mission-driven consultancy for nutrition and food advising for health organizations, startups, and companies. She subspecializes in empowering children of all ages with digestive and allergic conditions. And through her passion for food, psychology, and cultural humility, her unique and individualized perspective on nutrition has been featured on a lot of media outlets like Good Morning America, Very Well Health, Motherly, Health Talks, Insider, The Conversation, and Health Professional Radio, as well as professional conferences.
Wow. So really known in the media world. I'm very excited for this episode.
A great guest for this topic, for sure.
So what do you say we get to it?
On to the show.
On to the show.
Well, welcome, Vanoush. We are so excited to have you on today's episode of Nutrition Pearls, the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Yeah, we're so excited. And to begin, we normally like to start with a little icebreaker question. So, Vanoush, if you had to choose one superpower, what would you choose and why?
Mine is very strategic, and it's going to be very on par with our topic today. But if I had a superpower, I'd probably choose being able to speak any language in the world, because there's literally nothing you would miss. You could just go anywhere in the world and could get by. And I just love like the world that opened up with you with learning language. And I feel like, especially for dietitians, at least in the Bay Area where I live, we have a lot of Spanish-speaking patients, and when I started learning Spanish, I felt a whole world open up to me in a way that I just didn't anticipate, beyond just knowledge of the language, but knowledge of culture and practices and importance and sort of the way that language shapes how we think and feel about things. So I would love to have that knowledge of all the languages ever in the world, and also all the little nitty-gritty, fun little nuances that come with it.
The slang from different languages.
Yes, slang. The slang I'm still learning. That's hard.
I bet. And I don't know. I think that is one of the most unique answers I've ever gotten from that question. You know, you think like flying or, you know, invisible or read people's minds, but that's a really good answer.
Well, thank you. I wouldn't want to read people's minds, but I want to fly.
Communicate with them in their native tongue.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That'd be cool. Yeah.
Well, what a great answer. I love that. Thank you for sharing. So kind of diving into our topic today, we wanted to start off with a question just to get us a little more clear on what cultural humility is and what cultural competency is. So can you share to our listeners what that means for people who may not have heard those terms before?
Totally. I think, you know, taking a step back, I think a lot of people have heard of the term cultural competency in one way or another, or they've heard the term cultural sensitivity or awareness, but cultural humility tends to be one that people pause around a little bit more. They're like, huh, humility. Okay, that's different. And I just want to preface everything by saying, like, the semantics really don't matter. It's the underlying philosophy and the spirit of what we're trying to do and achieve here. So when it comes down to it, I don't want people looking at flashcards before going into a clinic session about competency or humility. It's really just about the spirit of what we're trying to achieve. When it comes to cultural competency, the one that people tend to know, there are a number of evolving definitions and, you know, there's a little bit of academic argument about what it really means, but ultimately it's defined as a skill of being able to interact with people of a wide variety of cultures and being able to take into account any kind of culture-specific needs. Some of the criticism that the term cultural competency gets is around specifically the competency part of it, in that when, as healthcare providers or professionals or academics, we are thinking about the term competency, we have like a flashback to like the checkbox of checking the competency and moving on, and it's done. We are now competent, door closed, like not looking back. And so this is where the semantics kind of comes into play and can be important, but I also would encourage us to not get hung up on it. The criticism is that that word competency is a strong one, and it evokes this feeling of like, you've learned this culture, you are now competent in, you know, Mexican culture, A+, and like never look back on it. And that's definitely not what we're trying to evoke here, because culture is fluid, it's dynamic, constantly changing, and it's not just related to like ethnicity or race. Yeah. So that's cultural competency.
It's not a box you can just check off. It's something you're always working on.
Something you're always working on, culture just in general. And so cultural humility is kind of more of the philosophy, the sort of action versus the noun of having this very other-oriented approach that really tries to put the healthcare provider in the shoes of the patient, like a deep, empathetic, compassionate approach, where we are kind of approaching the patient's words and thoughts and feelings with just as much weight as ours. There's not this sort of feeling of like, oh, I have 7 years of training and therefore I know everything and patient's wrong. Like, their word is like, we should be hanging on to every little bit of it because they are the experts in themselves. Mm-hmm. And we are acknowledging with humility that we don't know everything, especially around cultural practices. We can never know everything because by virtue, culture is ever changing, shifting. There are hundreds of thousands of them. Like, how are we going to know them all? We're not encyclopedias. And that the greatest teacher in the room will be the patient. And so it kind of allows us to surrender and ask open-ended questions and just like admit without shame or without feeling like, oh, I'm so ignorant that I don't know this. You just admit that, hey, I don't really know about this. Could you tell me a little bit more about it? I would love to understand what this means to you, so that they feel safe to share and that we feel safe to admit that, hey, I don't know, and I need this knowledge gap filled so I can support you fully. Mm-hmm. And so I love this because it's like the term captures the action, that it's ongoing, and it really pushes us to check our own biases, not project our beliefs on our patients, and just really continuously critique ourselves with compassion and knowing that like the final word does not end with us. It's really about the patient here.
I love the word empathy that you chose there, because I think, you know, there's such a difference between sympathy and empathy, especially when we're talking with our patients specifically. It's very easy to use more sympathy versus empathy. And that's the area that makes all the difference in the world for making patients feel comfortable and willing to share more. And like you said, being able to admit when you're wrong or don't know something, right? That's super important. So kind of going off of that, more specifically in the dietetics world, why is cultural humility so important for us dietitians?
Yeah, I just want to say I agree with you on the difference between sympathy and empathy before I answer your question, because I think it is such a important distinction with our patients feeling like seen and heard. And I think patients want people who are like clinically really sharp and they know all the stuff, but they also want someone who like speaks their language, not literally, but is just understanding of them and sees them. And I've had patients where I call them soul seers. They just see into your soul and like you felt that connection and that you felt like the thing you were working on landed. And I think that empathy is so important in that realm of making like that clinical, technical information actually land, actually be able to be implemented. It takes so much soft skills and counseling and soul seeing to actually get there. So why is it important in dietetics? I mean, those are some of the reasons. Actually, I didn't mean to just answer that question, but I think there's so many ways this is relevant and so many ways that this shows up. Cultural humility is especially important because there is a lack of diversity in the field of dietetics. And most of the formal training that we get in the United States tends to be very kind of Eurocentric or kind of doesn't really include the vast diversity of cultures that we work with on a day-to-day basis in clinic. And I was looking up the statistics because I knew they were quite high, but I was looking them up and I saw that in the world of dietetics, we are 89% female, so super female dominated, and that 72% of the dietetics profession is white. 10% is Hispanic Latino, 7% Black or African American, 6% Asian, 3% other, and 2% no answer. And this is from the CDR. And I thought this was unsurprising because this is what I encountered in my training. And this is what I tend to see in terms of representation. And, you know, something I say often, and part of the reason why cultural humility matters so much is that it's what is not represented, you can't fix. And so one of the things I notice in these statistics is that there's no box for Middle Eastern, North African. And this is one of those chants that I frequently chant, in that there's a total lack of representation there. So if you don't measure it, or if you don't bring up the conversation, or if you don't feel comfortable enough to explore these cultural varieties and influencers in your counseling, you can't fix the underlying issues, or you can't really help your patients. You can give the information that they can honestly Google, but how are you going to be the person who massages that information into something that is applicable to them, to their culture, to their beliefs, what is important to them? And that is the beauty of the practitioner, in that you're able to soul see, you're able to take that technical information, massage it into a way that they understand to really get there. And culture isn't just, as I mentioned earlier, race or ethnicity or religious beliefs, but it can be like the generation you're from, like millennial or Gen Z. It can be like sexuality or gender identity. So I would encourage us to think about like, what is the identity our patients hold that is most important to them, that is coloring their worldview the most, so that we can see from that lens with them. I think also, you know, when it comes to food, what greater expression of culture is there than food? It's one of the biggest ways to celebrate culture and togetherness is through food. And so we have so many patients, you know, like in the Bay Area, we have so many patients who are from Central American, South Asian, Southeast Asian descent, who have the best food cultures, like the best. Yeah. Like, I mean, I literally ate Thai food for lunch. I have a deep appreciation. I honeymooned there too. But they have just amazing food cultures. But I think because of so many different layers of like culture and identity, they come to the US, and one of the ways that they want to be the best immigrant ever shows up as, I'm going to eat American food. I'm going to be so American that I reject my food culture. I eat these foods, McDonald's and Hot Cheetos, because that's what Americans do. And, you know, you also see that in conjunction with like behaviors like rejecting their mother tongue and things like that. And so cultural humility is beautiful because we can also recognize some of those underlying identity crises, things that are going on, and say like, hey, these foods are amazing. Here's why. We are trying to get our other patients to eat like you. Embrace this. This is amazing that you have this. No, you don't need to be drinking Pediasure just because, like, the fact that you have all these other foods is amazing. So I really like the empowerment aspect of cultural humility too, because once you understand that, you can empower your patients and help them turn what is an insecurity for them into a strength. But it takes someone else to mirror that back to them and help them see. So I don't blame patients for feeling that way. And so many of our resources are not very multiculturally inclusive. So as dietitians, it's our job to kind of like always be assessing, not just within the patient dynamic, but within our like institutional environments, larger levels, on ways that we can be more inclusive and bring that cultural humility perspective on many different layers so that representation is there and it doesn't feel like an uphill battle.
That was such a good answer. They're coming to us for advice about food specifically. So completely agree that as the professionals, we need to be very aware of this and give our patients the most safe space that we can for them to bring up these concerns and us to say, you don't need to drink a Pediasure every day or, you know, work with them. Mm. So I totally agree with that answer. And I just hope this podcast can, you know, bring light to a very touchy subject for a lot of professionals and make it a little bit easier.
Yeah. I think a lot of professionals feel shy. They're like, I want to acknowledge that too. And I'm like, as you should, we feel shy with anything we don't know. We feel uncomfortable with anything that's new.
Especially something that we feel that we are the professionals and that we are. But
right. Yeah, absolutely. And that's why I think it's like the best part and the hardest part about cultural humility is that we release ourselves a little bit of that, like, I know everything, like I must know everything. And I have the board certifications and the training. Mm-hmm. Like you still have all those things, right? But with culture, you just can't. And it's okay to be like, hey, I just really don't know this. And that's so okay. I find it so freeing because I felt that since moving from like a practice, like in my early years as a dietitian, where I was just sort of relaying information and not really like massaging it to the person and making it feel like it's their information, I felt such a difference in the impact of counseling and feeling like closure with my patients that I just didn't feel before. And I always left my patient visits earlier on feeling uneasy because I just felt I'm just not fully seeing that person in the way that I want to. And so if anything, I hope that encourages our providers, like not just dietitians, but any provider who's feeling like something just didn't land. Like we all leave with that little uneasiness. We're just like, ooh, I know there was like an extra mile that we could have gone there.
So what was for you that really helped, like being just more aware of the cultural humility part? Anything specific that you could, you know, share for our listeners that really did it for you?
Absolutely. I think cultural humility is one part of it. Being very socioeconomically aware, being psychosocially aware of what's going on. And just, I think one of the biggest pieces of advice I give dietitians now is resist the urge to jump into a diet recall right away and really just get to know the patient. Like, how are you? How are you doing? How's this been? This diagnosis of IBD is a lot, you know, like, how has it been for you guys? Okay. And now I know we're here to talk about nutrition. Tell me what's on your mind, hearing what's on their mind. What is it about this thing that makes this such a concern for you? Like, I'm hearing some stress. I want to make sure that I get to the core of that. So just really like calling out the emotions, labeling it, seeing where they're at can be really helpful in that they feel seen and heard. And that you are also getting to the core of it. So like in a culture of humility lens, like I've had a lot of patients who are really hesitant to give their young children, like toddlers and infants, and even like 4 or 5 year olds, like foods that are rich in fat or whole milk and things like that. And they're really emphasizing fruits and veggies, and their kids really do need those extra calories for growth and et cetera. And when we talked about it, they told me like, well, in our culture, like giving lots of fat is considered bad or it's unhealthy. You know, in our culture, we have a lot of heart disease and this and that. And so like understanding the core of that issue was really helpful to like address the concern. Because it's one thing to say like your child needs fat, it's important, they have high calorie needs, et cetera, et cetera. Like the very logical, rational reason. Mm-hmm. But then there's the fear barrier and hearing that and saying like, yes, I hear you. That's a very understandable concern to have. And yet, independent of that, your child still needs this because this is what's going to allow them to thrive. And as time goes on, their diet will naturally transition to maybe not be as high in fat. And as long as we're emphasizing variety and keeping up the wonderful food practices you already have, we can feel confident that we are setting them up for short and long-term success. But it's just like finding those golden nuggets of information or those concerns that are like the key that unlocks the aha moments. I think I'm always seeking the aha moment. There's always something we're trained in nutrition and the science of it. So we think of things kind of really rationally, and it's like the air we breathe. But for patients, not so much. Their nutrition information is grandma, social media, cereal boxes, and like, you know, whatever TikTok thing is going around. So I always remind myself of that. I'm like, what is their source of information? It's not me.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big world of misinformation out there. So yeah, I think being persistent to find the aha moment in a very gentle and compassionate way can help you just feel like, ah, we got it. That was the thing.
Yeah, I think like what you were talking about earlier too, I'm hearing a lot of how to practically use this cultural humility, this empathy to build these relationships with our families who maybe had a really quick pediatrician visit because they only have 10, 15 minutes and they got a nugget of nutrition advice that they didn't understand, or they've never heard of that food that they were told to add to something for extra calories or a different type of drink, then the child doesn't like it. I loved what you said about like trying to start with how are you doing with this diagnosis and what's your biggest concern today? And I think that when I do that and when I have the time to do that kind of an approach, I definitely see more of a bond at the end of that visit than a rushed visit. And we all have that, right? Like we all have that really rushed visit. We run in, we do what we can, but yeah, you don't get that same satisfaction that like you really made a difference and you bonded with that family and they trust you and they'll trust your future advice too.
Yeah, they'll come back to you. They're like, this person took the time. I trust them. I can come back to them. I'm not going to feel judged or feel like I'm stupid or feel rushed out of the room. And, you know, like you said, clinic is clinic. Patient care is patient care. There are days where like there's just not time in the day. And like in those moments, I really try to lean heavily on summarizing, like, hey, I've read up on your chart. This is what I understand. I'm just going to give you a summary of what I understand to make sure we're on the same page, save you some time. Our time's a little short today, so let's just start our conversation. I would love to see you back in like X number of weeks because I really want to make sure you get everything that you wanted to get out of today. I'm sorry that our time is short, but let's just start and see where it gets us. And just like kind of calling it all out, like circumstances are unideal. And I really want to help you and we don't have time, but this is not the beginning of the end, but we can keep this conversation going. It doesn't stop here. And please don't let this color your perspective of what nutrition counseling is. It's kind of like what I'm trying to say. So in those moments, I just like try to call it out and say, this is not perfect. Let's start somewhere and we can keep this going. And don't be shy to reach back out to me.
I love that. That's great. Okay. I feel like that leads us into our first question, a little more related to how we're doing things with infant feeding and keeping cultural humility in mind. So we know that there's a wide variety of infant feeding practices around the world, different cultures. You already kind of touched on a lot of that. How would you, I mean, I guess you kind of answered this in a way, but how would you approach like a family who's coming to you to start solids? Any advice on like when they ask about weaning or breastfeeding goals and things like that? How do you approach that infant feeding transition talk with any culture, with any patient?
I think it's such a great question. And there's just so many ways that you can go about weaning and breastfeeding and underlying philosophies in different cultures that, again, color their beliefs and their perspectives of what they should be doing. That's influenced by many, 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 many generations of food practices. I ultimately tell people like food and eating is a behavior. We're learning it from people. So the way we think and feel about it is influenced by other people. So again, I start with the patient. I want to know like, what is it that they want to talk about? What brought them here? What's the backstory? Like, what is it that makes this feel like a concern? Or what is it that makes the topic feel like it's so important that we need to talk about it and that you've sought professional care for it? It's nothing really crazy, right? Like, what brought you in today? And what would you like to talk about? Not revolutionary, but really helpful to just identify what are the things that are on their minds. And then once I have an idea, I might ask, what drove you to this topic? Tell me a little bit more about it. And I may not talk for like a very long time. It depends. Some people will be like, oh, I read this article. I just wanted some clarification. Sometimes it goes into a thing of like, well, grandma says my baby isn't fat enough and that it's because of my breast milk and it's not fatty enough and I'm doing everything and I've cut out all the foods and like, and then it just goes and goes and goes. And I just sit and kind of watch and say, tell me a little bit more about like the breast milk thing. And then why is grandma saying that? Like, what is it that makes her say that to you? And then I might, you know, take it from there. I just try to take the whole picture of everything. And as I'm doing that, I often like write notes and write little domains for myself so that I don't forget. And we won't go through everything in the first visit, but I'll let them know like, hey, I see these kind of other domains and these are things we can talk about in the future. But for now, let's start with the things that I feel like would be most impactful for you. So what I'm really trying to do is just understanding the motivating factors that led them to clinic, the tone, the feeling, the stress, and then really try to validate and normalize all of these, which are going to help build the trust and safety and openness and increase the likelihood of them coming back to clinic and having that continued therapeutic alliance. On that thread, like again, given that infant feeding is so varied in the different kinds of practices, I'm always just asking open-ended questions. I don't make any assumptions. I have no idea what they know. I need to start with them to kind of do like a needs assessment. So I might ask things like, what kind of approach have you taken to introducing solids so far? How has that been? What's been going well? What's feeling a little bit challenging? You know, what do you want to work on? And I think there's many right ways to do this. So like as dietitians, I just want to make it clear that like, there's not just this one way we need to do this. And parents also need to know that there's just not one way to do this either. We have many right ways. And I feel like we're just trying to find the most right way for that one particular patient that works for them and their lifestyle. And that's going to look different for everyone. Mm-hmm. Like the goal is to just really be curious and ask. And even like when we question the sort of straightforward cases, oh, child is gaining, growing fine, but parents are just neurotic and they just want to talk to a dietitian and, you know, things that seem straightforward to us, I think it's really worth actually taking the time to understand the background situations, because most of the time our job is 99% reassurance, but reassurance just doesn't work if they don't feel seen and heard. And that's where all the magic happens. So understanding all of that can be helpful.
Yeah, I feel like this is going to be the repeating phrase, seeing the patient, hearing the patient, finding what they're needing and meeting them there, so that even in a cultural practice, we may not be, as the practitioner, like very aware of, we can ask questions and understand more about it so that we don't just, I could see it easily being like a quick judgment if you weren't taking the time, but instead like learning more about it, asking the follow-up questions like you told us earlier. And that can definitely change the entire relationship.
Entirely. I think too, like sometimes the things that make me pause or want to know more, be exceptionally curious, is like when I hear those labels, oh, this really anxious mom, or this really neurotic dad, or this really pushy grandma. I tell myself, well, people respond in that way probably because of something that made them that way, whether it's only related to food, independent of, or something. And so I just want to hear them out, right? There's a reason they're feeling that way. And if we just say, oh, it's fine, don't worry, like they're just going to feel more anxious, more neurotic, more angry because the need wasn't heard and they're going to feel brushed off. So we have to be mindful that like our reassurance is true reassurance and not like, it's fine, like move on to the next patient because I'm already behind and like I really need you out of this room kind of thing.
Yeah. Because,
like, you know, people are very sensitive to feeling rushed.
Which all goes back to the empathetic mindset, putting yourself in their shoes. If you were that parent with a kid that they were worried about, how would you want to be approached by a provider? So
100%, 100%. If this was your family member, how would you want to for them to have been treated by a provider? I also empathize with us as providers with the fact that like we have a million checklists. We have to see them. We have to pre-chart. We have to, you know, chart review, coordinate care, submit notes, bill, charting messages that come up, things that go wrong, formula shortages, all the things that literally make you want to pull your hair out as a provider. So some days it can just feel really hard to extend empathy to patients when you feel like your empathy bucket is running low. But I would say it's just like, it's more investment up front and down the line, it saves you a lot of time and effort because the issue will show up one way or another. If not in the first session, then later on when the core issue hasn't been properly addressed.
Oh, I love that. And, you know, kind of piggybacking off that previous question, what advice do you normally give regarding breastfeeding or formula weaning during, you know, that process of starting solids?
Yeah. There are so many misconceptions about how this is supposed to go, how weaning is supposed to go. And this varies widely in cultures too, like a lot of cultures regularly practice breastfeeding like well into the toddler and younger child years. Some just stop at like 12 to 15 months. Some have just a variation in between that. And the biggest confusion tends to be around how to balance intake of solids with intake from milk feeds and the sudden expectation of baby, like around 6 or so months, once they're showing the developmental signs of readiness, that they should be eating everything from solids. And you often hear this from parents at 6 months, quote unquote, failure to thrive. My baby's not eating any food. All they take is milk. They should be eating solids now. Like, what am I doing wrong? They're not interested. And this can be really stressful. You have this expectation. Your very vulnerable baby is not eating as they should. And you're feeling like a failure as a parent. And they're wondering so many things along the lines of like, what the heck am I doing? Can somebody help me? And having the parent, like I said, just like air out all of that can be really helpful. And then asking permission, which I love to do, to educate and just provide some gentle medical education, nutritional education, can be really helpful. So I might say something like, that all sounds so overwhelming. And if I were thinking of all those things, I would feel exactly as you feel. I think I have some information that might relieve you a little bit. Would it be okay if I shared that? The answer is typically yes. Like, it's totally fine. I've really never gotten a no now that I reflect on that.
But giving them the option to want to hear the information that you have. I love that you asked that.
Yeah. And, you know, like, I've never gotten a no, but I have gotten like, well, wait, there is one more thing I want to share with you. And I'm like, okay, yeah, go ahead and share that thing. And then that thing winds up being important and colors like the rest of our intervention. So not only asking for permission, but kind of like asking for readiness in the case of like weaning, solids, breastfeeding, formula feeding. I like to give a spiel on what is a generally expected timeline, what's normal, what's not normal. And, you know, emphasizing that like around 6 months of age, as long as baby is showing signs of readiness, this is a time to start solids. But like walking and talking, haven't really done this before. And they are going to make a mess and they're not going to eat sometimes. And they're just figuring it out. It's like experiencing a new country for the first time. They just need to figure out how to navigate all of this. So give them time, let them practice, be patient, expect enormous mess. And embrace that this is a very much a long-term journey and the process doesn't happen overnight. And that might mean that other people who think they know better are going to say the opposite of me, and that's okay. But you can remember that like this is what's normal for baby. And I'll emphasize like your job is to create that safe environment to really honor baby's cues and listen, look out for baby signs of hunger and satiety. And that is your job in honoring your child. And then from there, I just see what they think. I'll often ask after to see what lands and what doesn't. I'll just ask them, how does that sound? Is there anything new you heard there? Anything crazy I just said that just doesn't make sense to you? And I emphasize the absurdity. Like I say, is that totally crazy? Because I just want to see like where they land. And sometimes when you overcorrect or like you over exaggerate a little, they'll say like, no, it's not that. It's just that my grandpa has been saying all this stuff and like I feel really kind of anxious about this, and it kind of creates a space for that. So giving them that template of like what's normal, where to start, like 1 to 2 baby meals a day. Baby's not going to eat much, remember. And like other practices that they can do, like bringing baby to the table and laying a healthy foundation, can help them see like, what do we expect? What are some things that you can feasibly, tangibly do so they feel like they're getting the intervention that they want? And just reassure and empower that like, hey, this might be different from what family says, but know that this is normal and you know best for baby. And if you ever need someone to cheerlead you, you come back to us, okay? Making them feel just really, really supported. That will also tie into the conversation around weaning, and that I will emphasize that still like nursing and formula is going to be really important in those early months of starting solids, and that gradually baby will learn as they build up their skills. And some babies wean a little earlier on their own, some wean a little later. It's really okay. There's no one cookie cutter approach. So just keep that in mind, that we are not checkboxing your child. Like, we just want to make sure that they're generally moving along the timeline that we expect. And then just depending on where we're at, I might give some anticipatory guidance depending on baby's age about cow's milk and not replacing either breast milk or formula with cow's milk once baby hits that 12-month mark as well too. And just trying to give some anticipatory guidance around many kind of misconceptions in that realm. But I will pick and choose depending on capacity and timing and like how much information a family is giving me the signs that they can take.
Yeah. Don't want to overload them on too much.
Exactly. Yeah.
So that translates really well to our next question. Can you describe some cultural practices that are common that may not be beneficial to the patient? So things that, you know, have just been done because they've just never been changed, or if there are any common practices that you see are not nutritionally beneficial to the patient?
Yeah, there's so much variety in what we see. And I know I've said that probably 10 times already. And I just want to emphasize always that, like, a lot of this is influenced by many generations of behavior and practicing and modeling and in culture. So there are many things that are beneficial and many things that are non-beneficial. But in approaching any of these topics, I encourage dietitians and other healthcare providers to be super gentle in how we approach these, and very kind and curious and, what's the word, like, soft in how we approach these things, just to make sure that we are not coming off as judgmental of a practice. So some of the kind of non-beneficial practices that I've seen have been, like, offering sugary water to a colicky baby, for example, a lot of overfeeding and force feeding. This is really common. Like, you fill up a bottle, it's 5-6 ounces, you have to finish every last ounce. That's how the parent has a little bit of, like, clean plate syndrome, or the grandparent has a little bit of clean plate syndrome, where they just really want baby to finish that all. And so those are some practices that I see, or feeding with distractions, kind of tricking the baby to try and eat. Some cultures even view nursing as, like, dirty, or they avoid it, or aren't really open to the idea of nursing because of the taboo of it being seemingly dirty. What are some other things, like using certain supplements that may not be safe for baby, using certain teas that may not be safe for baby as well, to help with, like, sleep or colic or digestive issues? So again, like, here, if you're identifying some of those things, I encourage providers to, like, deep breath when you hear the thing that freaks you out on the inside, because it happens when I hear, like, oh, I'm giving my baby raw eggs and honey and, like, raw liver. And I'm just like, oh my God.
It's so hard to just be like, okay, deep breath.
Yeah. I take a deep nose breath and I'll be like, okay, so yeah, tell me more about that. What inspired you to do that? What led you to that? And often the intention is so pure. So we want to, like, honor that. We can say, like, I totally understand that you want to offer something as nutritious as egg to your baby, and, like, kudos to you for doing that. Would it be okay if I gave you a few tips to maybe optimize the experience, like keeping it very light and, like, non-judgmental? And that tends to be received well. Some folks are just uber sensitive to any kind of, like, feedback, especially around food. It's so sensitive. It's like the ultimate expression of love. So no one wants to feel judged in that sense. But I find that just being, just exceptionally gentle can go really, really far. Mm-hmm. And as you identify things that are, you know, classically non-beneficial, I really like to call out the strengths too. Like, I see you care so much. You're working so hard on this. You've even gone and done research and found something for baby. Would it be okay if I offered an alternative that might work better for your baby for, you know, X issue, like colic or whatever? So that's kind of how I try to navigate those situations. It's not to say that I don't internally freak out either. I really do. And I'm like, well, who am I to, like, freak out at them? They're just doing their best. I have degrees. They don't. You know, their mode of information is Instagram and, like, wives' tales. So it's like we have to be so mindful that, like, they are truly just doing their best. That helps me not freak out.
Yeah. They think it's what's best for their baby. So you have to respect them for thinking that and having that mindset.
And for trying, there's motivation there. That they're motivated to, like, make change. It wasn't the right change per se, but they have that, like, what do they call it in MI? There's, like, a change talk element to it, that they, like, want to make the change. They're ready to make the change. They just need a gentle guide. And that's what we do.
Yeah, that's what we're there for. I like that you said you point out strength, because I feel like in my practice, I definitely have been working on creating, you know, always starting with the positive, and then that's kind of your opportunity to give the advice afterwards. But always, always, always starting with the positive will create an environment where they feel comfortable in receiving whatever you have to say next. So I love that you said that.
I'm glad you brought up MI too, because I think what you're saying is just reminding me, like, this is, feels like a motivational interview talk. Like, this is very similar. And it's great, though. I think it's a really good reminder, the positivity in the beginning, the building the trust, the empathy, like, all of that is really just, like, working on getting the best for that kiddo without pushing yourself. Like, it's not like, hey, you're wrong, get out of here. It's how can we work together, which I love. I think that's great.
Agreed. And there's a lot. It's like you made a Venn diagram. There is so much overlap between cultural humility and MI. And ultimately, their foundation is in the philosophy of how we approach it. And I've been so happy with like how MI and cultural humility has helped me in like a personal realm too, of like being just better able to like not jump in and give my thoughts right away to like a friend, but just like asking like, well, what was it about that situation that made you do X thing that isn't good? And I've just loved that I can like hold space better for my friends and family. So it doesn't stop outside of clinic. It really is like a clinical skill, but there's so much personal growth that comes with it too. And it's very, very enriching and really inspiring to kind of see those little nuggets show up throughout your day-to-day life too.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. I do have a question. We talked a lot about, you know, having families feel comfortable in their cultural and bringing their cultural and food preferences to us. How would you approach a situation where someone, you know, that might be American but is interested in exploring other cultural foods? How do you approach that in conversation and trying to get more diversity in, you know, their American child's diet?
So you're saying like we have a family who is classically American, maybe it's a classical American diet, so to speak, and they're looking to help expand their child's palate. Am I hearing your question?
Yes, specifically in the infant time period.
I mean, absolutely. So in the infant years, do it all. It's all about exposure. And this kind of goes not just about food, but so much of infancy is just rapid development with language and speech and movement and touching textures and seeing different colors. And it also applies to food as well. So it's really an extension of show baby the world and like give them all the opportunities to experience these fun little things. In, I believe it's around like the 6-month window, there is a window of time where it's considered to be optimal for having a very wide and diverse diet for babies. So that can be a really great time to be introducing lots of different flavors and textures. It's, again, okay that baby doesn't necessarily consume it, but just interacting with it, getting a lick of it, mushing it with their little squishy baby hands, and just experiencing it is really a powerful experience. That said, you know, for folks and families who are very information seeking and they hear about this and they're past that window, it can bring on the sense of anxiety of like, we missed that window and now everything's going to just be so much harder. Sure. I guess I really don't like to belabor that point, and often I don't even bring up that window thing to families because it creates stress. There's an underlying anxiety of like, we have to get it in, and like, here's the Excel sheet, and here are the spices that we need to do. Like, we've all seen the patient with the Excel sheets, and I don't want to bring up that kind of energy, but rather encourage them to offer a wide variety. So if we're working with a family who maybe has a more simple diet and it's not herb and spice heavy, and it's just pretty simple, there's nothing wrong with that. I try and see, okay, what is it that you're doing? And like, what would you be open to offering? Because ultimately, whatever we do for baby, we want to be doing for the whole family and make sure that this is doable, it's achievable, that you're not short order cooking for multiple people in your home. And ultimately, like, we want to build happy eaters who eat varied diets that, you know, fit in with the family culture. So no point in offering uni if like your family's never going to eat uni. There's a chance to eat uni when you're older, right? So I think there's those aspects to consider. I think that covers the gist of it.
You know what, Melissa, I think that's funny that you brought that up, because when my son was starting solids, I feel like I expanded our entire family's repertoire of meals and snacks and things, because I was like, I have these things that I cook and like and all that, but what else can I give him? How can I expose him to all sorts of fruits and veggies and spices and things like that? And it really, like, to this day, like 3 years later, we're still in rotation with some of these baby food meals that I found on Solid Starts for sure. And then other like just random recipes that I found that I'm like, hey, I never thought about making this at home. It's easy. It's fun. It's delicious. Like, now he likes it and it's part of our normal rotation. So I think that was a great question, because I was like, hey, that actually happened to me on accident. Like, I expanded what I was willing to eat, and not like because I didn't like it, just because I like didn't think about changing anything and getting creative. So it could be an opportunity too. I wonder if like families just want that opportunity to be even just like more diverse in their own menus.
So, yeah.
It's like a great learning moment, right? Like they're just like so excited and so enthusiastic. Like, I want to do everything right. And we're like, okay. All right, let's go.
Power through.
Yeah.
Same. I love that you shared that experience because I feel like a lot of parents feel that way. Like that they want to do good by baby and they want to know where to start and they want to offer a lot of variety. Sometimes it's a little overwhelming because there's so much that we can offer, but I feel like you struck a perfect balance of finding things that like you have, what your family would like, that made sense for your family and would work. And I think that's sort of a wonderful way to like narrow down what we want to focus on because there's so many foods, there's so many things to introduce. What makes sense for you, your family, your culture, what's doable in a long-term sense, and then go from there. If we do all the right things all the time, you're never going to sleep. It's just, you're never going to sleep. And I also want to say that if you quote unquote miss that window, please don't stress because life and having a child is about one thing or another. You may have missed the window for like learning 5 languages. Well, they'll learn them later. Or like you missed the window for like optimal mathematical genius. You'll get it later. Like there's always something that has an optimal window. And like life is just going to be an impossible game of timing these optimal windows. And then you just forget to like have fun with your kid and eat at the table and get messy and laugh. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think that's what a lot of this is about, just enabling families and parents to have access to these foods and experiences and memories that are meant to be positive and fun. That's like what I always want to bring my families back to, especially the Excel sheet ones.
So kind of circling back a little bit about what you had just been speaking on about different cultural practices and things that you see that are maybe beneficial or a little less beneficial. So would you be able to talk a little bit more about like maybe the shift you've seen in infant feeding practices? When we're thinking about purees, baby-led weaning, combo feeding, I know there's a lot of information out there now. Do you want to just highlight some of the pros and cons of each and what you see in your practice?
Sure. Yeah. You know, to probably a little surprise to this group, there's been such an increased interest in baby-led weaning and in supporting infant self-feeding. And that is essentially what baby-led weaning is. It's infant-driven. It's a self-feeding practice that honors babies' readiness for taking in solids as well as their hunger and satiety cues. So we're moving away from that like tricking baby to take bites or force feeding kind of model that many of us have been kind of conditioned to accept and implement with children. It acknowledges that baby is capable. Baby, when supported, can do so many things if we create the space for them to do that. And that's what's really exciting. I find that the kind of like younger generation of parents, the now millennial parents, are exceptionally excited about this. And what I often hear is that they're drawn to it because it's healing for them in the sense of that what millennial hasn't had body image issues. We grew up with, you know, Victoria's Secret and all the things. So for a lot of parents, I hear them be attracted to baby-led weaning because of it allows baby that autonomy to listen to their body. It allows the parent to kind of heal their relationship and to like see what a healthy feeding relationship looks like in a baby. And it kind of is almost soothing for the parent. Mm-hmm. I see it a little less popular with like the older parents who maybe are drawn to more puree feeding. And I wouldn't necessarily say like one is best or better, but I think what's most important is that we're taking a very responsive approach in this. So that no matter what, like we are not force feeding baby, that no matter what, we are not pushing them to eat beyond their comfort level, that we're not tricking them into bites because that is dangerous. It overrides their internal hunger and satiety hormonal cascade system, which is beautiful, sophisticated, and it's happening between the gastrointestinal system and the brain. We want to honor that. They're born with it. As we grow into adults, we tend to lose it because we have all this. Our brain is like overriding our physiology, but we want to allow babies to hold on to that and continue to have that. With purees, there can be an increased kind of risk of feeling like you want to force feed because you just want to finish that jar of Gerber.
Like, one more piece,
just let me finish it. I just need to check this box off. Like, there's this like obsession with being done. I'm so guilty of this. Like, I'm so satisfying to like finish a box of a thing or something, but we don't want to be doing that. And so baby-led weaning allows for there to be this ultimate emphasis on allowing baby to lead the way. And what's nice about that is that it can be more accessible, right? Whatever family's eating, with a few small modifications, baby can eat. Like, decreasing the salt, sugar, making sure that foods are prepared in a safe way from a food safety perspective. It's easier to introduce common food allergens in the United States, like nuts, soy, eggs, and dairy. It's an easy way to connect with family and culture. So having spiced and herbed foods, foods with lots of flavor, acid, bitterness, earthiness. It's also fantastic for sensory development. It's messy. You touch all these things. You feel all these things. And it also provides more opportunity for like fine motor skill development.
And it's fun.
And it's fun. It's so fun. You like just go online and look up baby led weaning and just see a baby like try and eat a rib. It's so cute. Like if you're having a bad day, go on TikTok and look up baby led weaning, like number one treatment for a bad mood. Like
some of my best pictures of my niece are her with her baby led weaning pictures. They're my background on my phone. They're adorable. So
it's mesmerizing too, just to watch the baby. You're like, gosh, they're having like such a full experience. And it's not to say that like with purees or even a combo approach that you can't have that. Like there are ways to load a spoon and hand it over to baby and they can self feed. And that can be a nice sort of medium between like true baby-led weaning where they own the whole process to a combo between puree and baby-led so that maybe parents who are scared about like choking or it just feels too big, too scary, that can be a step there and they can build their confidence. But ultimately, like around 9 months of age, we do want babies eating finger foods and grabbing foods and being able to self-feed. So it's not a matter of if, but a matter of when and how we get there in a confidence-building way for parents.
Yeah, that's great. Do you think that there's like an education shift happening within maybe the dietetics world, maybe just like the healthcare world in general, where we're doing a little bit less counseling on starting purees at like that 4 month mark, like that older advice, and starting more like 6 month readiness cues, that kind of stuff?
I'd say there's definitely a big interest from the dietitian community, the pediatric dietitian community, to bring baby-led weaning to a wider population of families. I still think, though, many like academic institutions have a lot of like outdated patient handouts regarding solid introductions, like to your point, like of the very early 4 to 6 months, or it'll say to encourage offering things like egg pudding and rice cereal, which are not things we would probably want to start off with. So I think like the interest is there, but from like a formal institution perspective, like the action on an institutional level we're not quite there yet. And I think there's more conversations that probably need to happen to implement this, but that the interest that we're seeing from health professionals is really exciting, very grassrootsy. And I see a lot of the education happening kind of on social media channels that are ran by health professionals. So we have like a reputable professional behind it and websites as well. And there is, you know, ongoing literature in this space. So to your question, I think there is a shift happening. It's still very early stage. I would love to see the shift reach larger institutions so that we can all be kind of united and that there are many right ways to start solids and that there doesn't need to be just purees or just Gerber or all these staged purees, and that we can find middle grounds that work for different families, their comfort levels, and are more founded in science, I would say, because there's no reason to offer egg pudding to a baby as a first food.
Yeah, all we need is some extra literature behind it to get some extra buy-in. Like you said, it's all science-based. Mm-hmm. And once that comes out, we're going to see a huge, even larger shift than we already have seen in the past couple years. So I'm excited for it. I'm really excited.
Me too. Me as well. I think, too, the other thing about the literature is that in the feeding space, it's so hard to get funding. And I think as dietitians, we can resonate with like nutrition funding, right? There's no drug at the end of this. There's no money maker. Like the only thing this is going to do is sort of shift knowledge. Getting funding for something would be so challenging. It's also like a long-term intervention, which increases the cost of any kind of study intervention. So I think the literature that's there is really nice. It is sparse. We need more of it. And I think there are barriers to getting that research out there, despite the high enthusiasm for, you know, the funding reasons that I just mentioned. But I know there are super determined people out there who are going to make it happen. So I am waiting eagerly for them.
As we all are. So transitioning to our last question, and we want to thank you so much for joining us today. This has been such a wonderful talk. I'm excited for our listeners to hear this episode. But our last question is, what resources would you recommend for RDs looking to learn more and expand their knowledge on cultural diversity in dietetics and infant feeding?
Well, it's a pleasure to have been here. This is such a favorite topic of mine, just a total passion of mine to talk about, you know, cultural diversity and infant feeding and just ultimately empowering providers and families to feel capable and feel encouraged to kind of go in the uncomfortable zones and get the most impact that you can for your families. One of my favorite resources in the kind of cultural humility realm is the organization Diversify Dietetics. I'm a member of their organization, and they just have really fabulous like resources on cultural humility, on expanding cultural awareness from a dietetics, nutrition, and food perspective in ways that many of us likely did not get in our training. So they're really filling in a gap that is there in our academic training. They also have mentorship programs. So if anyone's like a new dietitian or looking to be mentored, they have that as well. Another dietitian I'm really excited about, and I love her work. She's sort of like dietitian / investigative journalist. She's really cool. She's called the Anti-Racist Dietitian. You can find her on Instagram. And she also has a site where she does like a weekly newsletter on really interesting topics that make your head spin and really reflect on like psychosocial, political factors that impact our patients' health when they come into clinic and helps you see the wider scope of what's going on. So I love her work.
That's cool.
If you're looking for like classical cultural humility and bread and butter, like just want to better understand it, the paper on cultural humility by UCSF CHO doctors, Dr. Tervalon and Marie Garcia, is an excellent paper. And then because we said this earlier, but cultural humility and motivational interviewing have so much in common. That spirit is really one and the same. And I really love the resources from Molly Kellogg, who is a social worker and dietitian. And I just love that she has the perspective of both formal counselor and dietitian. And she does a fabulous job of helping dietitians feel more comfortable to ask counseling questions and knowing when we need to be referring to counselors and when we identify sticky points. So I love that. As for in the infant feeding space, Solid Starts is such a wonderful resource. There is resources for parents from like the First Foods database that runs through different kinds of foods that families can offer and how to offer them in safe, age-appropriate ways to reduce the risk of choking. There are also guides for families who are looking for a deeper dive, and the Instagram channel can also be a lovely way to get some gentle education for parents to be. I've heard many parents like to follow and just pre-educate themselves before baby comes and before they start solids so that they feel ready to go when the time comes. And more recently, we have a pro-professional portal where we're offering continuing education for health professionals, pediatricians, dietitians, OTs, SLPs, in a wide range of topics, including like the neurobiology of swallowing, how to provide socioeconomically sensitive nutrition counseling, to a foundations course that sort of outlines the baby-led weaning philosophy, the existing information there, kind of dispelling myths around iron, sugar, salt, choking statistics, and whatnot. So that's really exciting. It's in its earlier stages, but it's something that's going to continue to grow and build as well. And I think there are a number of solo dietitians too, and OTs too in Instagram. So if you're looking for a wider perspective, you can absolutely go to social media and just make sure, you know, our folks have credentials and that it's not just any person sharing right. infant feeding.
Yeah.
So there's no limit to resources when it comes.
There might just be like too many at this point, but that's okay.
And we will put the links in the bio for some of the resources that Vanoose highlighted today for our listeners as well.
Fabulous.
All right. Well, thank you so much again for joining us today on our episode.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been such a pleasure. I'm really excited to have this podcast reach a wide range of dietitians and hopefully other health professionals. And I hope, if anything, you guys feel inspired to kind of go the extra mile, go the extra step with your patients and feel comfortable in doing that and know that you will make mistakes, and it's literally the only way to learn. So make mistakes and have fun doing it. It's all a part of the journey.
Oh, I love that. Thanks so much. We really enjoyed having you.
Thank you.
All right. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Oh, wow. That was a really great episode.
Yes. Vanus was great. Three takeaways that we got from talking with Vanus today. I'd say number one would be both cultural competency and cultural humility are important to practice as dietitians. And it is important to remember that culture is dynamic and ever-changing, and it's something to always be working on. You know, at the end of the day, your patient is the expert in their culture, and understanding this can lead to a deep, empathetic, and compassionate approach that we all strive for as dietitians, you know, every day with our patients.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that ties into one of my takeaways from it was that just like when we're counseling our families, resisting the urge to just jump straight to the diet recall, like getting to know them, spending the time in the beginning just to develop a rapport, it helps us understand what their concerns are, where they're coming from. And also, I feel like it puts you on an even field with them. Like you're not coming in as this person who's going to lecture. You're coming in as a person who's on their team and part of their kids' medical team, and you're helping them in the future, right? Like you're going to be there for them.
Absolutely. That's a huge takeaway I got as well. And I know as a practitioner myself, I'm always looking for more resources. How can I get better at this? What can I, you know, where can I look to get more information? And I think Vanus had some really great resources that can help us all become more culturally diverse in our practice. A few she mentioned were Diversified Dietetics and the Anti-Racist Dietitian to learn more just to bring to your practice, and more in the diversity in the infant feeding world. She mentioned Solid Starts, and I think that's a great resource, not just for professionals, but also for parents to go to.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
So if you don't already, please consider following the show. We will announce upcoming episodes on the CPNP social media accounts, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. If you are a CPNP member and have a topic idea, feel free to email us at cpnp@nasbegan.org. The information discussed during these episodes is subject to change over time with new developments and advances in the field of medical nutrition therapy. Nutrition Pearls is supported by an educational grant from the Reckitt Mead Johnson Nutrition. Thanks everyone for listening. Bye. Bye.